not easy to cross the border from Canada into the United States anymore. It's certainly not as easy as it used to be, and it's not that easy coming back either, depending on what you're doing, where your passport says you're from, and where you're attempting to do it. Because not all border crossings are created equal. Some are serious ports of entry designed to process tens of thousands of crossings each day, and those are located on major routes between major cities. Others are smaller and more out of the way, and those crossings serve communities. Some serve them well, but others exist in places that can make life difficult for those who do have to cross and can make life downright miserable for those who have to do it more than once a day. And this is one of those border crossings, the crossing that might in fact be the toughest in Canada. And you will no doubt be shocked to learn who gets the worst of it. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
There's a quiet silence or acknowledgement of these stories and not enough of a sense that should we be talking about this?
Sonia Fata is a writer for The Walrus and other publications. She's also the editor-in-chief of JSource. Sonia, where is the toughest border crossing in Canada?
So according to me, it's in a place called Akwesasne, which is a reserve that straddles the U.S.-Canada border and actually straddles two provinces, Ontario and Quebec, and New York State, and it's right by Cornwall, the city of Cornwall in Ontario. There's an island that is placed in, that is located in the middle of St. Lawrence River. And there's a border that runs right through that island and through New York State, Akwesasne on the New York State side, as well as Cornwall Island, which is part of the reserve on the Ontario side. It makes it tough because people in Akwesasne who are from the Mohawk community essentially live in the Quebec side of Akwesasne as well as the Ontario side and the New York State side. And they live and work in different parts of Akwesasne. And so they're constantly traversing that border back and forth, whether it's to drop their kids to school or to go to work or to visit grandparents or friends. And so people live all across different points because this is like a land area that's 3 kilometers square or something.
Right. So where on that sort of 3 kilometers square area is the actual border check-in station and what does it look like?
So it used to be that prior to 2009, the border post was on the island. And then in 2009, the CBSA decided that they were going to arm all their border guards. And the decision to arm the border guards resulted in a bit of a furor in Akwesasne, where people said that is akin to an act of war against our people.
So they would have Canadian border guards armed on Mohawk territory.
That's right. And so there was a resistance, and I think that resulted in a standoff between the CBSA and the people. And what happened is the CBSA people basically left their post. And because they claimed that they felt threatened. In the aftermath of that, there was a period where the border was not controlled at all. And so people were going back and forth for a period of time.
Okay.
Without any controls. And then the CBSA moved its post onto Cornwall proper. Although I should mention that even that piece of land that they built a new facility on is now contested as Indigenous land. And there's a land claim on it that the current Grand Chief of Akwesasne has put through.
So the border station is in Cornwall,
fully on
the Canadian side of the St. Lawrence.
That's also debatable because the Mohawk Grand Council claims that it is actually land that traditionally belonged to them.
Right.
That land claim has been rejected and they're putting together a new proposal to try and get that through. So what you will see in Akwesasne is people going back and forth. They're going to work. They're coming back to, you know, visit their parents or go home. And each time they're going back and forth, they have to go through the border and report.
Give me a specific example. Tell me about what someone's everyday life could look like crossing this border.
So let's say you live in, I'll give the example of April Thompson, who is the protagonist of my piece. April lives in New York State and essentially works on Cornwall proper. She works in the city of Cornwall for a school as a counselor. Her ex-husband lives on Cornwall Island, which is in Ontario, but in Akwesasne in Ontario.
Right.
So her daily commute would mean leaving her house in New York State, going through Cornwall Island, entering Cornwall, going through the post.
Right.
if she decided that she had to drop something off at her ex-husband's house or at a friend's house who lives on the island, she would first have to cross the island, go into Cornwall, report, then go back to the island, drop a person or a package or whatever she had to drop or meet someone there, then go back in, report again at the border post, and then go into the city to do whatever she had to do, in this case, go to work.
How often do people in the Mohawk community or even just other people who are using this border crossing actually do all that?
I think they do it every day, sometimes multiple times a day, because literally you have parents in one place, grandparents in another place, you know, schools in one place, workplaces elsewhere.
Right.
And so there's a lot of people who are going back and forth all the time.
And they don't just jump the border or fail to report.
I think people do sometimes decide that, well, we're going to report at one point. Are we going to report it each time we go back and forth? So I think
it seems insane.
Yeah, I mean, it seems quite, like, if you think about it from your own point of view, and if you're living in Toronto, let's say in Parkdale, and you work downtown and you're going back and forth, you know.
You also have to drive to the East End first before you can go
exactly,
back downtown.
Right? I mean, just think about that in a different context and you realize how ridiculous it is. It's also ridiculous because there's an acceptance of Akwesasne as a territory. And so the question of mobility, which this whole piece kind of raises, is a legitimate question to ask.
How does the Canadian Border Services Agency keep tabs on all these crossings and who is checking in at the border and who isn't?
That's a good question. According to CBSA, and this is what they told me when I reached out to them, they have a complex mechanism. They have video reporting. They have their own officers who report. They have support with the Mohawk Police Force. And so they report.
Right.
They have some kind of collaboration with them. And they also sometimes rely on people,
mm-hmm.
you know, public reporting. So, for instance, if you've made an enemy or a friend or you have someone, you're really upset at someone, you probably should watch out.
That sounds
ominous.
Yeah.
And in the worst case scenario, it is ominous, I think.
And the fact that there's video surveillance, this is a Mohawk community.
Absolutely.
How do they feel about that?
Well, I think it's really interesting because people in the Mohawk community aren't really sure how to fight this battle, right?
Yeah.
It's either they're fighting for operational flexibility. Can we have a card so that we can move back and forth and just kind of zap it and not have to stop and go through the process? Or do we ask this bigger question, shouldn't we be able to move freely within Akwesasne, card or no card, right? And so it gets kind of stuck between like operational like flexibility and the larger question of mobility, which comes up when you have a court case like April's. But then ultimately on the day-to-day, they're just kind of trying to negotiate a better passage of movement.
So tell me about what happened to April and how she did end up with a court date.
April and her ex-husband have two daughters, and one of them, Caitlin, was, I believe, at 18 at the time of the incident. And she was visiting, she was with her mom, and her mom was going to drop her off at her ex-husband's place
on
Cornwall Island. He was supposed to pick up the daughter, and he called her and said, do you mind dropping off because I can't pick up right now? And so April realized it was a bit late and she'd be late to work. And so she thought, I'll just drop her off. On the way, and then head to the border, report, and go to work, which sounds like a pretty reasonable thing to have processed mm-hmm. and thought through.
And
she doesn't really know how she got caught. But when she got to the border after having dropped Caitlin off at her father's place, she was pulled over and asked to come inside. And then she was told that she had been spotted and it was clear that she'd dropped her daughter off, and she had aided in the illegal entry of a person into the Canadian territory.
Also sounds ominous.
Absolutely, especially when we're talking about your daughter and your ex-husband.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So she ended up spending 7 hours in a cell, and everything that she had on her was confiscated, and she made a couple of calls. She made one call to the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne informing them, because in addition to holding her, they had taken her car and impounded it. And there's a lot there beside the CBSA entry point. And you'd always see 10, 12 cars in that lot. At any given time, the fee to get your car back once it's impounded is $1,000, which is a lot of money for for anyone.
Yeah.
So she ended up spending 7 hours in there. When she got out, she began to think through this and she wondered, she just kind of frazzled by how ridiculous this whole process is, and now she had this criminal record, a potential criminal record. She'd also, this had happened once before with her, so she became aware that this could be a more serious issue for her personally in terms of her own record. And in conversations with the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne, she decided that she would use herself as an example to or a case study in in asking this question about mobility. So what the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne was thinking, if we can use April's story, and around the same time, there was another woman, Alicia Shenandoah, who had had a similar experience. She had dropped her niece off to a lacrosse game, had a similar run-in with the law and the same charge.
Right, just dropping somebody off on the island on your way to go check in.
Exactly.
Because it's insane to do it the other way.
Right. And in her case, we're talking about a six-year-old child. So the two of them put their cases together, and the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne supported them and helped them kind of bring this case against the Crown. But the challenge was, in the court case, they're limited by a couple of things. One, the Indian Act, which is the central document that governs relationships between the Crown and Indigenous communities.
What does it say about this in particular?
Nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, not the specific incidents, but in terms of where the
cross-border?
Yeah, nothing?
No.
Really?
The challenge here was that all previous kind of precedent in terms of law was along the lines of on issues of Aboriginal rights, because this is what this was. This was a demand for an Aboriginal right. On the issue of Aboriginal rights, the framing was around a case that involved, which was R versus Van der Peet. And in that case, the issue was, if you want to establish an Aboriginal right, it has to be linked to a traditional custom or practice.
Which is hard to sell
going
on
to school,
crossing a border.
Yeah, well, and going to school or going to a lacrosse game doesn't quite constitute a traditional practice. And so this is called a frozen rights approach. And there's quite a healthy debate around the frozen rights approach. Not everyone agrees. But I think there's a sense that the frozen rights approach essentially limits or reduces the whole argument around Aboriginal rights to that you have to be practicing some kind of traditional practice to qualify.
As opposed to just moving freely around your own traditional territory.
Right. So what it does is it doesn't understand or appreciate that communities evolve and change in practice as well, but has this kind of very stereotypical attachment around rights and norms. But the other challenge was that in order to even qualify for this Aboriginal right, the lawyers would have to prove that prior to 1609, the Mohawk community did travel and move about and fish and practice all their traditional customs in this particular area that is today the St. Lawrence region.
That seems either difficult to prove or just stupidly easy to assume that, of course, they would.
Right. And for one thing, to even have the archaeological or historical record that would be able to prove that is challenging. And the second part of the problem is that it's kind of odd to just choose 1609, which is as the point of contact.
Right. Yeah.
And that becomes the point from which, you know, Indigenous people, or particularly in this community, can kind of assert their rights. So it's really reductive in its framing. I first heard about this story when a couple of lawyers were discussing it. I was just thinking, oh, that's really fascinating that there's this region and that people are going back and forth. And my immediate thought went to, well, how does this impact people on a day-to-day basis? But the conversation there was all about border security. And in researching and looking at previous stories on Akwesasne, I saw that a lot of work had been done through the framework of border integrity or border security or the Crown's role in protecting its borders. And part of the challenge had been that Akwesasne and Cornwall had been in the news and been tagged as the contraband capital of the world because of smuggling across the border and because of the ease of smuggling because of the island and water.
Right.
But I was fascinated that there hadn't been enough reporting on what this did to people on a day-to-day basis. And I was drawn to it also because as someone who has experienced challenges in terms of traveling across borders and have been through like security clearances and that kind of stuff, as a person who doesn't have any reason to go through that kind of process, it made me think about people who would be struggling with that kind of stuff. And the most significant part of that was how regularly that kind of surveillance happened. And they had this kind of really big brother sense about it, right? That there was this constant surveillance on this island.
Right. Well, when you worry, you have to worry, like you said, about your neighbors possibly calling the border services because they didn't like the way you left your garbage cans on their property.
Right. I mean, all this kind of stuff. And I think also this idea that, there's a lot of literature on over-surveillance on communities and what it does to communities, but also how it distorts the figures in terms of illegal behavior. So that drew me to it, and I thought, let me find out. Let me get in touch with April, and let me see what her story was. And in my experience, going to Cornwall and talking to people, almost everyone has a border story. If it didn't happen to them, it's happened to their mother or their father or their brother or their sister or their grandparent. And there's a quiet silence or acknowledgement of these stories and not enough of a sense that, should we be talking about this? And if we are talking about it, does it in any way impact us negatively when we do cross the border? Which is not to say that all CBSA officials treat Indigenous people in a certain way when they come back and forth. I think everyone knows some of the officials and says that there's respect, and I know that there has been some cultural training and all of that. But at the heart of it, you forget how in the big picture, it's so deeply problematic. There are some people who are just at that point where they're so fed up and they've experienced this over the course of their lives. And one of those people is a woman called Donna who lives on the island and lived there with her husband, Antoine, who was a former chief. And he had quite a violent interaction at the border a couple of years ago. And that interaction started because he was pulled over. The CBSA official said she sniffed tobacco. And so she pulled him over and said, we're going to check your car. And he said, I smoke, so you're smelling tobacco because I smoke. And she didn't accept that and basically asked him to pull over, and he refused to get out of his car. And so he was pushed down on the ground, and eventually one of the guards came forward and said, we should stop because he's clearly not well, and an ambulance was called and he was taken to hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He had said that he was on his way to hospital because he'd woken up feeling quite ill, and at that point he didn't know he had pneumonia. He was hospitalized for a couple of days, went back, and 2 months later he died. And Donna has said that she feels very strongly that that incident, although he was already unwell, that that incident contributed to his early demise.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been one of those people who's been very active in terms of writing to CBSA every time an incident happens. And so she has a record of letters and interactions with the CBSA on various matters. Another thing that happened with her was her grandmother, who was ill and in a retirement home on the island, was someone who she would go and visit every day. And her uncle lived on the New York side, and he would come in and visit his mother on the island regularly. And they would usually meet late at night and spend some time with her together.
Mm-hmm.
On the night before she died, he had left his card at home. And so he got to the border, and he wasn't allowed to come through. He subsequently went back home, and Donna said she waited and waited and she couldn't, and he didn't show up. And her grandmother died that night. And the problem with that, of course, is you could argue that, well, he didn't have his card, so he couldn't get through. But presumably, he'd be a very familiar person to the people at the border post. And there would be an alternative way of checking someone in and just making a note that didn't have his card, but we know who he is. And we see him every day for the last X number of years. And so those kinds of stories, Donna was furious about this, wrote a long letter to CBSA again and got a response back from CBSA apologizing and saying they would look into the affair. But I think that Donna is somewhat exceptional because she's one of those women who actually articulates her grievances. And I think a lot of the stuff that we don't hear is the stuff of the everyday that people then absorb and becomes part of their...
Right, just part of the routine.
Part of their routine.
Part of the grind of having to live there.
Yeah.
Where does this stand right now in terms of the fight to have it recognized
the right of mobility is still something that it awaits its next court case when something else happens and the council decides that perhaps it's worth coming together as a force and fighting it. Until then, I think there's a couple things happening. I think that the CBSA is interested in trying to facilitate a better situation. And one of the things that has long been in question is, should we have some kind of an automated car process,
mm-hmm.
kind of like a nexus for people in Akwesasne. But the challenge was that you'd have to go through a heightened security clearance. And so there'd be a lot of people who may not make that clearance. And if they didn't make the clearance, they wouldn't qualify for the card. So it wouldn't be equal for everyone. They've really struggled with finding a solution that is at least operationally more humane than the current process. There is an effort right now to try and find a new way of getting to that. And I know that there have been negotiations between the CBSA and an external consultant and the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne. There has been no clear resolution yet. But to my knowledge and to the way I see this whole situation, that's still very much on the operational side of things. I think the question of mobility is still something that's just kind of lost for now.
It's been lost for a long time.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so I think it requires a different perspective. And my hope by doing this story was to try and talk about it from a more human perspective, that if you see the impact of this on regular individuals, you're more likely as a reader or a listener to be more compassionate in terms of realizing that, well, if this happened to me in my daily life, how would that be? And how would I look at this?
I hope we've done that. Thank you, Sonia.
Thank you.
Sonia Fatah, writer for The Walrus and other publications, editor-in-chief of JSource. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head over to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Check out some other episodes. Suggest some stories. We love it. Find us at frequencypodcastnetwork.com as well if you're in the mind for some other podcasts. And whichever one of our shows you're listening to, please do rate and review and leave a comment. And don't forget to hit us up on social media. On Twitter, we're at TheBigStoryFPN, and we are at Frequency Pods. You can also find us by searching Frequency Podcast Network on Instagram or Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.